All right, commandment number 6 tonight, and week number 8. We are more than halfway, obviously, at this point, and it's about the time. It is light out a little bit longer, but it doesn't feel like temperature-wise where it should be. We enjoyed our spring already, and now we're headed back into wintertime. But tonight we are on commandment number 6, thou shalt not kill. And obviously it's one of those commandments where we probably feel pretty comfortable in some ways that we've kept. And I think that we'll see that there are some areas that we need to work on as well. Let's look at the opening paragraph in the notes, page number 83. To kill is to take the life of another person. I think that's pretty obviously. This could be done accidentally or intentionally. To murder is to intentionally take the life of another living being by evil intent or premeditation. Jesus takes time to clarify this statement, thou shalt not kill, in the New Testament, when being questioned about the Ten Commandments. In his answer, Jesus said, thou shalt do no murder, Matthew 19:18. The distinction is found in the intent, and in many cases, the innocence of the person that lost their lives. It is unjust violence, murder is, as opposed to taking of a life by the command or the allowance of God, in other words, capital punishment, self-defense, legitimate warfare, etc. Murder is forbidden first for the fact that God is the giver of life and no one has the right to take it but Him, or at least by His command. It is forbidden secondly by the fact that man is made in the image of God and that image is not to be marred. We see this in Genesis 9:6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And so murder is forbidden, secondly, because man is made in the image of God, and therefore we are not to take matters into our own hands and mar that. Clearly there are times in the Bible when it was right, proper, and even commanded to kill. Ecclesiastes 3:3 tells us that there is a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up. There are those that would even say that it's unjust to kill animals for food, sport, or fur. You may know some of those people, and we met some of those people in Washington, D.C. They were nothing but entertainment to us. And but anyway, we'll just add that in. We know that that prohibition by given by people is refuted by God in many different places. This commandment has some obvious exceptions to it that must be understood from the Scriptures before we can be certain on its framework and guidelines. This will be covered under the framework of the law. So here we are in the fallout of the law. Letter A, we have the punishment for those that murder. Okay, so we're going to start with that, the punishment for those that murder. People who take matters into their own hands and take the lives of someone else. Number one, the punishment for those that murder is the curse of God. Genesis 4:10, we know that to be true of Cain, and he received God's curse because of that. What is it that thou hast done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And we'll be touching on this in just a little bit tonight, but imagine if the blood of one innocent person was crying out from the ground for justice. Imagine what is going on because of all the abortions in the United States alone. And now thou art cursed from the earth, God said to Cain, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. And so God had placed a curse on Cain for what he had done, the very first murder. We talked about this with our students on Sunday as we're in Genesis 4 in our study with them. And I just cannot imagine. I told them I've never been in the presence of someone when they died. I have been in the presence of someone who is dead, but never in someone's presence as they died. And I think that, you know, doctors, nurses, they can kind of describe to us what that experience can be like. Can't imagine what it's like the first time for someone who is not prepared for that, who's not trained as a doctor or as a nurse, to be there when someone is actually taking their final breath, whether because of a violent trauma or whatever, but to actually be in their presence at that point, it can be pretty traumatic. And imagine the first time that it ever happened, the first time, no explanations, There was no doctors who could describe what it was going to be like. And we don't even know if Cain understood what it meant for someone to die. Did Cain understand that this death would be eternal, forever? Did Cain understand that there would be no recompense, no bringing back of this person? We can assume that he probably did, but he had no books to read that told him what it was going to be like. And if you can imagine that first time actually watching not only a stranger, but his own brother who he killed with his own hands, taking his life. It's also interesting that we're not told how Cain killed Abel. We do know that his blood was shed. We're not told if he used a rock, an instrument of some kind. We know it wasn't strangling, or his blood would not have been shed. And so that first time had been quite an experience, even for someone who committed the murder. But he experienced the curse of God. Number two, we have the anger of God. This is one of the punishments received. 2 Kings 24:4, and for the innocent blood that he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. And God is angry with those who murder, who take the lives of other people. In other words, they are taking his place. We've talked about Jack Kevorkian before, someone who, if you accept abortion as okay, as morally okay, then you probably have to accept mercy killing as okay as well. Someone who is under a disease or under the pains of a disease, and to help them out by taking their life, that is what Jack Kevorkian did. I got to tell you that I don't think any of us would want to be in his shoes when he stands before the judge, capital J, as he has taken the lives of many people, but also imagine, as we mentioned earlier, the doctors of those who commit abortion, those doctors, the abortion doctors, experiencing the anger of God. Number three is the judgment of God. God says he will punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. In other words, justice is coming. Justice will be had. God will not forget those who have died. And it does seem like at times that will happen in our society with the millions of people that have been murdered, not just those in abortion, but people that have been murdered. Our society, because we are human beings, many times cannot figure out who the person is that has murdered someone. Some bodies have shown up years and years later. You know, we get pictures of people who are missing. We don't know if they're murdered. I heard the radio interview of Jessica Smart. Was it Jessica? Has said that in a way. Just this last week, and it's been, I can't remember how long it's been now, since she had been kidnapped. She was kidnapped for a full year by some lunatic couple. But for a full year, the parents held out hope that she was alive, but they had no idea. And there are children missing every day. They could be dead. Who knows? But anyway, there are many times where it appears like justice will not be served. What happens with all these murders that have not been solved? No one has been brought to justice for them. But we do know that God says, I will take care of those. The earth will not always cover her slain. And God will take care of those things at some point. Number four, under the punishment, number four is the death penalty. We're going to get into this a little more in depth in a few moments under the case laws. But the death penalty is one of the obvious punishments for someone who murders. Exodus 21:12, he that smiteth a man so that he die, he shall surely be put to death. No questions asked, no compassion shown, he shall surely be put to death. Number five, the mark of taking on the character of Satan is another obvious punishment. And John 8:44, your father the devil, and it goes on to say that he was a murderer from the beginning. And so we take on that. Very mark. It is said of Cain in the New Testament that he was of the wicked one. And he took on that marking of Satan. Is it possible that some of the murders that take place happen under maybe demonic possession? I believe that very well is the case in many, if not all. I mean, I shouldn't say all, but maybe close to that. He is a murderer, the Bible says. God is not a murderer, and we would not take on his character by doing that, but we would take on Satan's character. I imagine that there are some cases that are even more obvious when someone is murdered, when someone is mangled, someone takes bodies apart, and we've heard too many stories of that in the United States alone, but demonic. And Satan is a murderer, and he was from the beginning. The beginning when? There's that word, the beginning, and obviously we're talking about with Cain. All right, the effects of murder on the land, not only with people, but there's effect on the land. Number one, the Bible tells us that the land is polluted. It is polluted. Numbers 35:33, so shall ye not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. And let's again go back for a moment and remember, take abortion again. If the blood is not cleansed from the land of the United States of America, unless the person who shed it is killed, we're not doing so well. We're not doing so well. Of the many people that have put on death row, it takes, it's almost an average of 20 years to put someone to death on death row. At the cost of millions of dollars apiece, $20 million about on average, they say, to put someone to death because of all the appeals and because of all the things that take place. And so it takes an awful long time, and very few of the states actually ever follow through with it. Very few. I think Texas is probably the one that follows through the most consistently and with what they do. But the land is polluted, and it is not cleansed until the lives are taken of the people who actually have murdered. Number two, the land is also defiled. So we have number two, it's defiled. And Deuteronomy 21, it says, the body should not remain, if someone is hanged, the body should not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day, for he that is hanged is accursed of God, that the land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. And so the land can be defiled. Number three, the land mourns. It mourns. And you know, land obviously is an inanimate thing. It is not something that has life in and of itself. And at the same time, there are times when it acts as if it does. Because number four, it tells us, it vomits its inhabitants out. And Leviticus 18:25, the land is defiled, therefore do I visit the iniquity upon it, thereof upon it, and the land itself vomits out her inhabitants because of the sin, because of the iniquity. And so the land is affected by that. It's an interesting thing, and some people take this more seriously than others, and I think that it's probably just wise counsel that when you move into a new house, that you take time to put it under the blood of Christ. Take time to pray over your property. And we decided to do that in our house. I have no idea of anything that happened in our home. The couple that we bought our house from were there was actually two owners to our house before we took it. We heard of nothing bad that happened. But at the same time, I'm not going to take any chances. Demons did inhabit, fallen angels did inhabit locations in the New Testament. There was a place called the Land of the Shadow of Death. And there were places that demons and fallen angels inhabited. I didn't want my land to be one of them. And so I took time to pray over our place, our house. I took time to pray over our property. And I just think it's a good idea. What can it hurt? You say you're being a little bit, maybe a little bit crazy on that. Well, some people might see it that way. I see it as being careful. And if the land can be defiled, then our land can be defiled. And if someone committed sin in our property, I don't want that to linger for my sake or for the sake of my family, and so I deal with that. I would encourage you to consider the same thing. Letter C on page number 84, the effects of murder on the total community. So not only on the individual, not only on the land, but also the community. This could also be seen as a case law, but I felt it fit under here in this explanation. The closest city to a murder scene was responsible to make reconciliation with God through a sin offering. This is also in the case where the murder could not be solved. So if murder happened in a location and there was no witness to it, a body was found, the community that was closest, they would actually measure out who was closest. And this is what Deuteronomy 21 says, if one be found slain in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it, lying in the field, and it be not known who hath slain him, then the elders of thy judges shall come forth, and thy judges shall come forth, and shall measure unto the cities which are round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, the one that is closest, even the elders of that city shall take an heifer, which hath not been wrought with, and which hath not drawn in the yoke. God's being very specific about this. The elders of that city shall bring down the heifer into the rough valley, which is neither eared nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And so they're going to take an actual offering. They're offering an animal, a clean animal, in this situation in which a murder could not be solved, or they weren't sure which one it was. And so the city was drawn out, it was measured, and the city closest had to make an offering. In this thing, I have along in the notes here, that there are times when people are going to take defense of this whole concept. Now, let me get into that when we get into capital punishment. We'll move into there in just a few moments. There were times, by the way, when God killed, and some interesting verses on this, but we know that he believes in capital punishment. He stated that. But there were times when God also killed. And an interesting verse that causes our eyes to go up a little bit on the understanding, in Exodus 4:24, it came to pass, by the way, in the end, that the Lord met him, speaking of Moses, and sought to kill him. And so there's some things there, some interesting considerations there. God was responsible for those who died in the flood, Noah's flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, and many others. As a matter of fact, one of God's names is the Lord of hosts, or the Lord of the armies. And so God is definitely in support at times of that. Now, the framework under this law. Look at the framework. There were times, I want to look at some of the standard case laws of things that would fall under this commandment. Number one is warfare. We need to understand the concept of warfare according to the Scriptures. It is an interesting time to live, and we know the president was here in Rochester just today. There are people that will protest no matter if he was throwing a birthday party for everybody, there would be someone protesting, and that's understandable. People are just going to do that. But people protest war based on whatever feelings they have. They don't feel that war is warranted. And they would just assume we sat with our hands together, twiddling our thumbs together, while people can go around and take pop shots at us and knock down some of our buildings and kill our inhabitants, kill our citizens, and we're just going to sit there because we don't want to offend the extremists because it might make them mad. Well, you know what? It's a little bit late. I think they're already a little bit offended at things because they've taken matters into their own hands. And there are times when warfare is biblical. And I want to look at some of these examples. Many times, number one under this, many times the promotion of war was straight from God. 1 Chronicles 5:22, it says, "For there fell down many slain, because the war was of God." God is the one that said, this is what's going to happen. There were times, obviously, when God sent David, and God sent his people to kill people and to make war. Exodus 15:3. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. David said this, "He teacheth my hands to war," speaking of God. God is the one that trained him, taught him how to fight. And the examples can go on and on, that many times war was directly from God. Does that mean every war is directly from God? Obviously not. But there are times when it was. Now, there are number two, there are righteous causes for war based on three principles. Based on these three principles, number one is the defense of justice. The defense of justice. Was it correct for us to go to war in regards to 9/11? Well, was it the defense of justice? It's a question we can ask ourselves. Was it just for the innocent people that were in those two buildings and in Washington, D.C. and on those airplanes? Was it just for their lives to be taken? Were they guilty of a crime? Is that the purpose of killing them? So there was a defense of justice. 1 Samuel 15, and this is God speaking. This is something that the Lord did here. Samuel also said unto Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice, the words of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts." And this is what God is going to say. "I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt." God said, "I remember that. That was not right. That was not just for them to do." And he said, I'm commanding you to go and to kill them. Now look how severe God was. He said, "Utterly destroy all that they have. Spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." God was serious. And God said, "This war is of me, and this is what I want you to do." Now, I have to tell you something, that even under the command of God, I imagine it was difficult for God's people to do that. I can understand someone shooting at you in a war. You're going to shoot back and not feel so bad about it. But you walk into a town and God says, "Kill that infant," that's going to be a little bit difficult. And God's people had to do that because God said so. God had His reasons. God said, "This is just. This is right. Just do what I say." And there was a defense of justice. God said a little bit more even on in Deuteronomy chapter 20. Deuteronomy chapter number 23. I have in the margin a little note, a little verse, Jesus and war, because so many people say Jesus would never fight. They obviously don't understand the second coming. But not only that, I know his first coming, we talked about this before, but his first coming, the purpose of his first coming was not to condemn. It was not to judge. His first coming was to make salvation available, to die on the cross. But Jesus did make this statement in John 18:36. "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews." In other words, Jesus was saying, "Listen, if this were my kingdom right now, if my purpose to be here was to set up my kingdom, my men would fight." And Jesus thus putting a stamp of approval on that. Letter B. The second reason, a righteous cause for war, is the suppression of evil. Deuteronomy chapter 7, let's read verse 16. It says, "Thou shalt consume all the people which the Lord thy God shall deliver thee. Thine eyes shall have no pity upon them. Neither shalt thou serve their gods, for that will be a snare unto thee." God giving his direction to his people. These were the nations that were before Israel being in the land. They were an abomination. They were murdering children, offering them up to their gods, burning them, and many other things that they did, and that caused God to say, "We're going to get rid of it. We're going to cleanse that land." And before they got there, they wandered until the fullness of their wickedness was come to pass. Verse 26 in that same passage says, "Neither shalt thou bring an abomination into thine house, lest thou be a cursed thing like it. But thou shalt utterly detest it." So God was describing the evil of these people, and he said, "I want you to take care of it because of this reason, because of their evil." Letter C, just war because of the defense of the homeland against an enemy. Defense of a homeland. But when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines came to seek David. David heard of it and went down to the hold. The Philistines also came and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into mine hand?" And the Lord said unto David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into thine hand." So the Philistines were coming up against Israel, and David went to prayer. And David didn't always do that, by the way. He did at the beginning. He was always praying, "God, should we do this? Should I go up again? Is this the right time to go up against these people?" In this situation, he did. God said, "I will definitely deliver them." And they came up again just a few verses later. Verse 24, they came up again. Verse 22, verse 23. When David inquired of the Lord, he prayed again. And God said, "Thou shalt not go up, but fetch a compass behind them." So God sent them around. They ended up fighting them again and winning. But the point being taken from here, the defense of the homeland, God warranted it. God said it's okay. It is the right thing to do. number three. The law gave regulations for those that can and should serve in the military. And here's the exemptions that God gave to His people. In filling the military, here are some exceptions. Number one, exception was given to those that were not of proper age. And God gives the age in here 20 years old and upward. So in God's way of doing things, when God was when they were in a theocracy, God said this, 20 years old and upward, no younger. And I'm sure there's very good reasons for that. But God said, that is the age that I am looking for. No one younger than that. It is a sad thing to see over in some of those countries overseas, these young children, 6-7-year-old boys carrying around automatic weapons and just shooting them off. And I just, you know, you see that we worry about slave labor. How about slave military? Kids that have no idea of anything different. But God said 20 years and older. Letter B, exemption was given to those that were fearful. Boy, now that would empty an army out pretty quick. And we know the example of that in Judges chapter number 7, when Gideon had his men, and God said, "Send all of them home that are afraid." And his army emptied out pretty good, didn't it? But this is important to the overall morale and faith of God's people going into battle. You and I know this to be true in a sport, man. If your team goes into a game beaten before it even starts, you might as well forget it. And it's the same is true for the military, and it really is contagious. If a military, a group of people are headed somewhere and they're fearful, they're afraid, they have no. The zeal of walking into what they're going into. Not that, I mean, everyone's going to have fear at some point. And we're talking about an overwhelming fear. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8. The officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, "What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go home to his mom." No, let him go home and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. And so it was an important thing to God to get rid of those that are afraid. Letter C, exemption was given to those that had recently married. This was so that he could build a good foundation in his marriage. That's Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse number 7. Letter D, exemption was given to those that had recently built a house. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse number 5. And then letter E, exemption was given to those who had recently planted a vineyard or a garden. And some of those, God has His reasons on some of those. I wonder about the garden thing. I'm sure that there was people all of a sudden thinking they were great farmers when war was ready to break out. But obviously, God wanted to have those in the military that were there for the right reasons, who could fight. I mean, you read about David's mighty men. One man taking on 800. One man standing in a bean field and just taking on a whole army. And those are the kind of guys you want in your military. You don't want some guy who's going to literally, you know, go into a fetal position and start crying when things are... You don't want that to be your fighting partner. The guy's guarding your back. You turn around, the guy's just like in laying down on the ground crying. Number four, other regulations on warfare. Armies were to offer peace to the city first. The city that they were going to battle against, they were to first offer peace to them. You guys want to give up yet? And give them the opportunity to surrender. Obviously, this was only in the cases where God had not ordered total destruction first. And this is Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10. When thou comest nigh into a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace, and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, slaves, and they shall serve thee. But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save nothing alive, nothing that breatheth. So God was saying, this is offer peace first, unless it's the people of that I've given you for an inheritance. Those you do, you are to kill without question. The second thing, letter B, if the offer of peace was not accepted, then mercy was no longer offered to the men of that city. This is how it continues on. And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it, surround it, cut off all of its supplies. When the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thy hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women, and the little ones, and the cattle, and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shalt thou take unto thyself, and thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies, which the Lord thy God hath given thee. And so in those cases, obviously mercy was shown to the children, to the women, and they were allowed to take of the food. Letter C, the military was to keep their camp clear. They were to bury the waste that came from their own bodies. And that's why they had the paddles on the end of their weapons, so that they could bury their own waste. And the reason being, God said, because I walk there, and I don't want to step in it. And so God was pretty clear about that. So that's warfare. There are some right and just times when warfare was to take place. Is it wrong for our country to go to war? No. If it's under the biblical pretenses and reasons for going to war. Should a Christian fight in war? Well, that's something you're going to have to answer yourself. But I know this. If my country tells me I'm going, then I have to. And I'm going to do that. What about a Christian killing? I mean, what if that happens? Well, again, let's go back to Old Testament when God commanded it to happen. Did God hold them responsible and put that blood on their hands when He commanded them to go and to kill? Obviously, He did not. And so there's going to be some of those. There's some tough situations that have to be considered, but understanding some of the principles from the Old Testament. Dave?
What would you say to somebody who said that because there's nothing in the New Testament about warfare, they took a stance that a country preemptively, like some people say we did, going to war, it is wrong. I disagree with that myself, but how would you answer something like that?
Who wants to give some input? It's a good question. You're talking not even just war, you're talking about... What do you mean by that?
Where the example of turning the other cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Just taking
down
the chin.
Somebody walking your house and slapping your mom down, you can block and beat your mom down. I would. I'm not going to turn the other cheek. Let my mother turn the other cheek. That's my thing. I don't know about you guys, but self defense.
Okay. So in issues of self-defense, can you give some...
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I almost get the feeling that in the Old Testament, you're kind of giving guidelines to how to run a nation and a nation of laws and so forth. Whereas in the New Testament, it seems a little more interpersonal, like it's more interactions with my fellow men. It seems like it's more of a detailed kind of a precedent. So I think that, you know, if a man slaps you in the face and him, you know, okay, you insulted me. If you feel like insulting me again, go ahead, just don't do it to my God or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I haven't looked through all this stuff, but I know that like the Mennonites and the Amish, their biblical stance is non-resistance. And they back that up with scripture. I haven't really dived into looking at that, but they believe, you know, God's in control of all things. And so they just adapted non-resistance from the beginning of that movement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else?
Romans 13 says that the government bears the sword, not the main. And Shannon said, men, and I think that God there is in control, and he does. But the government there, he gave them the sword, the power, and they are to be the executors of execute wrath upon them to do evil.
Mm-hmm.
So government absolutely has given the command to use the sword for good causes. So if you're found in the army, you're in the government,
and I would obviously say, you know, if you're living in Iraq and, you know, the president of Iraq says, go and take these people's lives because they looked at me wrong when I drove through that town yesterday, obviously that's a little bit different than our country defending itself against terrorists and terrorist networks. So I guess, you know, there are some tough things to be faced. Is warfare totally out of the New Testament? I mean, there's some examples. There was one situation in the garden where one of the disciples says, we got a sword, and Jesus said, sufficient, it's enough. He didn't let him use it afterward. As a matter of fact, when Peter did use the sword, he cut off Malchus's ear. Jesus put the ear back on and said, put up your sword. But again, he's also the one who said, if this were my kingdom, my men are going to fight. I think that the problem we have so often is we write off the New Testament or the Old Testament because we live in the New Testament. Although some things change, God doesn't. And just because the Old Testament, we live in the New Testament, doesn't mean that everything in the Old Testament is now nullified. You know, so, well, God was a man of war in the Old Testament. Well, he's a man of war in the New Testament too, because that is his name. If that's not true, then God's also not jealous, because that's an Old Testament name for him. And we so easily want to write these things off because it's Old Testament. Obviously, there are issues of self-defense. Does God expect me just to let someone beat me up or beat my family up? I doubt that to be true. Again, the one illustration being that of Jesus with the sword. You know, it's sufficient. That's good. Have that. Why? Well, I mean, maybe he was preparing them for some self-defense. That's something to be faced. If God, again, God's a man of war, Old Testament. God's a man of war in the Second Coming. God's a man of that principle of justice, punishment in the millennium. I don't know why we change him so much in the era we live in. anybody else got something to add to that?
When we separated from England, did we have justice in going to war there? Did England mainly head over taxes and those taxes taxation with our representation? I mean, was that war political at all? Because it seemed like in that war, it would have really helped America win that battle. But,
well, that wasn't the only thing, taxation. Obviously, it was also separation of church and state, which doesn't mean the same thing in the year 2006 as it did back then. But the difference being, obviously, we don't want to be told how to worship God, and you're not going to legislate how to worship God, which is what the Church of England was doing. I would say that there was justice for the believers in that situation. And so I think there's more to it. I understand the taxation issue was a part of that, of us separating, but there was also other things. The whole reason why we came over. And so I think there were some more to that than just that. I don't know if that, maybe someone else has better insight on that than... Okay, letter B, capital punishment. Capital punishment. This is the taking of the life of a person for the breaking of a moral law ordained by God. There are several modes of punishment that are available to the society under biblical law. These included whipping for minor offenses, restitution in cases of destruction or stealing property. Now remember, these aren't capital punishment. These are different forms or modes of punishment. Labor to pay debt or restitution, or confinement for accidental killings. But now there are two forms of capital punishment in the Bible as we move to the most severe. First, there were times when God exacted death on someone himself. A couple of the cases given there, Exodus 4:24, one that we read earlier. Or he gave command for the society to do so without delay or hesitation. Now, we've got a listing here of specific times that this was enforced. Here are some of the examples of this. Number one, intentionally taking the life of another person. We've already seen that. God said, if you kill someone, your life is taken. Number two, striking or cursing a parent. We read about that under command number three. Number three, kidnapping, the stealing of a person. Exodus 21:16 says, and he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. Again, taking ownership of something that is not ours. God created. Number four, adultery. Leviticus 20, verse 10. I have under here some of the case laws that God gave, some of the relationships that might otherwise be overlooked. And here's the listing of them from Leviticus. A man with his mother or stepmother. A man with his daughter-in-law. Now these are an abomination. God says you've wrought confusion in these things. And these are, they seem obvious to you and I, but to a decrepit society, they become more accepted. A man with his mother-in-law. Forget it. A man with his sister or stepsister. Leviticus 20:17. A man with his aunt. A man with his aunt by marriage. A man with his sister-in-law are some of the examples given in the book of Leviticus chapter 20. Obviously, there are more relationships, but these cover the ones that are the most critical that God brought to our attention. Letter B. A man that sleeps with a woman on her monthly cycle. God said that is not to happen. They shall be cut off from among their people. Now, there are some that argue that the terminology to be cut off simply means to be excommunicated, kicked out of the community. And that could be true at times. But there are also times when it would mean that their life is taken. A little explanation given below there. One must come to the conclusion that the terms in this text, cut off, and bear his iniquity, to mean death in the form of capital punishment. The beginning of this text helps to clarify this by saying that a person giving their child to Molech worship would be stoned to death. And then in the next verse repeats the penalty by saying that they would be cut off. And that's given Leviticus chapter 20, verse number 2. And then there's another situation, 1 Samuel 28. The term is used in the account of the witch of Endor. The woman said unto him, unto Saul, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath said, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land, whereof then thou layest a snare for my life to cause me to die. And so there are times when obviously it means, the cut off means to kill. Capital punishment.
Those are the relationships. Number five, capital punishment. Prostitution and general unchastity. Deuteronomy chapter 22. If you can imagine, in these situations so far to this point, people often argue that capital punishment does not deter evil. I don't understand that logic. Let's at least take it at bare minimum. It is going to deter the person who has been killed. Right? Someone who is dead can no longer commit the crimes that they were committing. It at least does that. But you and I know the Bible. And we also know our human, the way our body, our emotions, our mind works. When I'm driving down the road, we'll take this example again, and I see a guy pulled over on the side of the street with the police officer lights flash and all of that, I check my speed. It's just automatic. We learn lessons from people around us. Sometimes we don't learn for very long, but we do learn some lessons. We see what happens. Ananias and Sapphira were killed. God said, you lied? Shouldn't have lied to the Holy Ghost? Dead. And what happened? The church feared. All of the church feared. There is something to be said for that, for punishment. We learn lessons from that. And if you and I can imagine up to this point so far what would happen in our society if we followed biblical law, if our society followed biblical law, and instead of putting people in a warm cell with all the nice food, cable, the workout, college, all of that stuff that we give them, and instead of pampering them, if it became actual punishment for them, how it would deter them from doing that, doing some of the crimes. If we were to see someone next to us die because of the crime they just committed, I am going to avoid that crime. We as, when you were growing up, you probably knew when it was a good time to ask mom and dad a question and when it wasn't. You knew the system. You knew that mom and dad are in a good mood. It's time to ask for the cash. It's time to ask for the keys. But you also knew that when your sister or brother just got hollered at, I think I'll wait a little bit longer. Because you knew that it wasn't good timing. That's our human nature. And we do learn from capital punishment. We learn from that. Our society learns from that. If someone knows that they can murder and be in jail for 6 months and then be out, what's the big deal? That person ticked me off. I'm going to kill him. I pay for 6 months, and everything's okay again. I'm back out in the society. And that happens for a lot of people. And you know what? You know, just on stupid things, the way maybe a lawyer handles it, something gets said, and they're let out on technicalities. And it's an amazing thing. Number six, bestiality. Probably the only sexual crime looked down upon in our country to this point. But they're making inroads. They're making inroads. Now, people laugh at me when I say this, and people think again that I'm wacky, but I believe that Beauty and the Beast is just an inroad to bestiality. You think about a beautiful woman falling in love with an animal. Now, did she know that that animal was going to turn back into a man when she started kissing it? No, she didn't know that. So what is it a promotion of to our children? Okay, think I'm crazy. It's okay. You can go ahead and think I'm crazy. I'm just telling you, our society is working on this one because the last vice that our country does not accept. 50, 60 years ago, we didn't accept homosexuality. It was disgusting. It was despicable. They were in the closet. Now they're out of the closet. Now it's everything's okay. So now we're working on bestiality, and it's coming. And believe me, it's a crime that happens in our good old United States of America. You can go on the internet and find out. You go on some of the news agencies, and you'll find the crimes are happening.
Well, I think the Lincoln Park stories are now pedophilia.
Mm-hmm.
They're definitely making very strong inroads
to pedophilia. Pedophilia, it is happening. You know, I mean, that is something we all understand. That is just ridiculous. It's gross. They're making a lot of money. They're making a lot of money on that stuff. And
huge organization, huge money. That's very powerful, very well heeled, very well respected. And they spend a lot of time in Washington lobbying. and they're making progress.
It is going to happen. Bestiality is next on that list. Number 7, death penalty for homosexuality or sodomy, as it's mentioned in the Bible. And Leviticus 20:13, and reiterated in Leviticus 18, and it's condemned in Romans chapter number 1. Number 8, the rape of a betrothed virgin, someone who is engaged to be married, death. Number 9, the involvement of witchcraft. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. But not anymore. Now it's okay. That's just another accepted religion. Yes?
For number 8, like if that happens, was the marriage still going on though? Or was it really considered? Or whoever. Oh, they both got that?
If she did not scream, if she did not call out for help, she would die as well. If she was raped, she was not killed for that. So if she cried out for help, obviously that meant she was not consenting to this. Then she was rescued from that. He was killed for that. And there's a good explanation in that text in Deuteronomy chapter 22 that kind of answers those questions. Involvement in witchcraft, we mentioned number 10, the offering of human sacrifices. does that go on in the United States of America? Number 11, rebellious children that cannot be controlled, reformed, or impeded from their evil actions. Again, that's one that we've mentioned under commandment number 5. Can you imagine again how difficult that would be for a dad or a mom to have their child put to death because of that? Because of rebellion. Blasphemy against God, number 12. Number 13, the defiling of the Sabbath day. Number 14, false teachers are those that propagate a false doctrine. Old Testament, God said, put them to death. The sacrificing to false gods. Number 16, refusing to abide by the court's decision, and which is thus denying the law. Being a lawless person, in other words. Number 17, failing to restore a pledge, stealing or oppressing the poor. And so that's number 17. We'll stop right there. We'll take a 10-minute break, and we'll pick up on number 18. We're on page number 91, and under number 18 for reasons instituted by God in the Old Testament for capital punishment. And number 18 is abortion. Here's the verse, Exodus 21, verse 22. If men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. And obviously, when you read this, if the fruit depart, and yet no mischief follow, in other words, the child is delivered, but the child lives, then you just get the punishment of what the husband prescribes. Whatever he decides is what you get. And but if the child is delivered and dies, in other words, mischief follows, verse 23, he says, then thou shalt give life for life. And so there's that's something to be considered. So God sees the child departing out of the womb and mischief following, in other words, the child dies. That is abortion. That is a child being taken and a child being killed. God said it's a life for a life. And, you know, interesting, this last week, and I made a copy of this article. This last week, when I first heard this on the news, I couldn't believe how stupid it sounded. You've probably heard this, but let me read this to you. Men's rights group sues to get out of paying for unplanned children. This happened in Michigan. The National Center for Men, didn't know there was one, but this is great. They have prepared a suit nicknamed Roe v. Wade for Men. to be filed Thursday in U.S. District Court in Michigan on behalf of a 25-year-old computer programmer ordered to pay child support for his ex-girlfriend's daughter. The suit addresses the issue of male productive rights, reproductive rights, contending that lack of such rights violates the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. The gist of the argument: if a pregnant woman can choose among abortion, adoption, or raising a child, a man involved in an unintended pregnancy should have a choice of declining the financial responsibilities of fatherhood. Now, I heard that and I thought, that's ridiculous. The guy ought to pay. Well, of course he ought to pay, but listen. When you live in our society and a lady gets the right to say, you and her have a child, she gets the right to say, you know what? I don't want the child this time. You're saying, hold up, lady. I want this child. No, I'm not going to. You don't have a right to stop her. So in that kind of mentality, I think these guys got a point. Now, is this whole philosophy a God-given philosophy and a biblical mindset? Well, no, neither is abortion. So all of a sudden you have a society given to abortion. This makes total sense. If the lady can make a choice, hey, I'm not going to have this child, and the guy can't do anything about it, well, that's not equal. Well, then she says, well, I'm going to choose to have this child. I don't want you to have that child. I don't have any money to support it. Too bad. Well, that's not right. It seems kind of a little bit unequal. Now, this is what happened. This guy's name, his name is Dubay. He says he's been ordered to pay $500 a month in child support for a girl born last year to his ex-girlfriend. He contends that the woman knew he didn't want to have a child with her and assured him repeatedly that because of a physical condition, she could not get pregnant. And she did. And now she's making him pay $500 a month. And so he's suing. And do they think they're going to win? He actually says in here, I don't think I'm going to win. But why not raise some eyebrows and at least raise some concern over this? You know, like I said, the first time I heard it, I thought, this is stupid. You should have made the choice not to get in bed with her or pay up. But when you get the mentality of the world, it makes sense. You have people choosing to abort, children that choosing to have the child. If the lady can choose all that, where's the guy's choice? Again.
Has any rights to the woman? Because, you know, the woman has the right to do whatever she wants. That's why they put the man on the side, and we don't care what he says or not.
Yep.
The woman has the rights. I mean, because
it's her child. It's in her body. Right, but if she chooses that, then the man should be able to choose whether or not he's going to support. It is stupid. And but that's going on right now. That was last week, March 9th. And that's happening in good old Michigan. So we have abortion, the taking of the life of an unborn child. Number 19. Here's for you, those of you who have a dog. Owning an animal which had a previous record of violence that has killed a person. I got a Rottweiler in our neighbor's house. Supposedly has the electronic fence, and it better work, because this dog's getting big. They got it as a puppy. The dog loved us and all this stuff. Now, that was in the fall of last year. This dog has tripled in size over the wintertime. This dog better be nice, and it better listen to its electronic fence. There's another Rottweiler on our street, across the street and down just a little bit. This dog is so large that when it snows out, these kids go sledding behind their dog. They get in a sled, and the dog runs down the street, and they're flying. Their hair's pasted back, and these kids are flying down the road. This dog's big. I was running one time in our neighborhood, right across from Dan Jelowick, and the people used to live there. Was that, what kind of dog was that, Dan?
Doberman,
yeah. I don't know what it was, because I melted. And this dog, I was running. I was in the middle of the road running. And this dog came tearing out of the garage. And I'm telling you, it ran the length of its front yard at me. And I don't even know what, I didn't know what to think. So I'll count that. And I mean, it was running as fast as it could, and it stopped right at the edge of the road and then started pacing. I go, oh, Lord. Yeah, it had electric fence. You know, it was buried under there. I didn't know that. And so I thought, I just had my last day. I just knew that I was done. But anyway, if you have a dog that has a history of violence, and your dog takes someone's life, you are responsible. And it doesn't give, obviously, the example of a dog. It gives an example of an ox. And but it gives responsibility to them. Verse 29, but if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and has been testified to his owner, he's been warned, your ox is out of control, you better take care of it, and he hath not kept him in, but that he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and the owner also shall be put to death. So you got an animal that's out of control, not taken care of, you are held responsible. Capital punishment. Now, a few other things in regards to capital punishment I want to make note of here on page number 92. First of all, capital punishment was administered in a few different forms in the Bible. These included stoning, burning, hanging, and the sword. And someone has made mention of this verse already, New Testament, support of capital punishment. Paul says that that they do not bear the sword in vain. Never been spanked by a sword before, because that's not the intent of a sword. The sword was intended for taking a life. And so they are. That is a support verse of capital punishment in the New Testament. They don't bear that sword in vain. The purpose of capital punishment seems obviously for the protection of the innocent, the eradication of the evil person, and a sense of fear instilled upon anyone considering the same sin. The process was a careful one, including the fact that an accusation could not be brought by only one witness. We're going to make mention of both of these things again in just a moment because it's important. Numbers 35 tells us that there had to be more than one witness. There were circumstances that would require the witness to take part in the stoning. This could help with some that would bear false witness. Another important guideline was that when it comes to carrying out the death penalty, one must not let their emotions cloud their judgment. God reminds us clearly in Numbers 35:31. Moreover, you shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer, which is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. In other words, don't take... If he's willing to confess in regards to someone else, don't give him a less sentence. Don't take any... None of that stuff is biblical. You got a guy guilty of murder, then he ought to be executed. All of a sudden we say, well, if you'll rat on someone else and tell us about it, we'll only give you a life sentence. We'll give you life without parole. But if you give us 10 years. We'll just put you in prison for 10 years. The Bible says that's not accurate. That's not the way it ought to be done. The taking of a life was permitted in these two areas in a community setting. This was not the responsibility of individual citizens to carry out. Obviously, God did give some room for the avenger of blood if they were a close relative, and they could obviously take matters into their hands in that defense. The guidelines were clear and were to be followed. The system worked great if God's guidelines were obeyed, but when they were not, injustices would happen to innocent people. Let me just read a little portion of what Rush Dooney says in regards to this whole concept. He says, we have seen the principle, it is life for life, a punishment proportionate to the crime. This crime has no reference to the criminal or his mentality, but only that the nature of the act. Scriptural law has no plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. Neither is there any privileged status before the law for a minor. Murder requires the death penalty, whether the offender is an animal, an insane person, or both, or a child, or someone who is feeble-minded. The law is clear. So that brings us to this next this next point, that capital punishment leaves no exception for age or mental illness. God doesn't say, well, check to make sure they understood what they were doing. If they didn't understand what they were doing, then we'll just have them checked out in a psych ward and put in the rubber room. And God doesn't say that. He says their life is to be taken. Too many people claim that today. I didn't realize what happened. I mean, I remember which case it is most recently, but it's going on right now where the guy's now claiming that he doesn't remember. His wife was killed, his one kid was killed, and his one kid was injured. I remember that happening. I don't know what happened. Well, where's the blood come from? What's that?
A couple weeks ago, I ran into him and said, "Hey, I'm dealing with solids." I forget the guy's name. I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Boy, he's all throwing, he ain't care in the world." He goes, "So I'm afraid of him. And his tendons are messed up because when he was hacking, I think the wife, his hand slipped off the handle and went down the blade. He messed up his tendons. So he couldn't bend his fingers." So my buddy says, "Just to work him a little bit," he says, "Domingue, what's wrong with your fingers? How come you can't bend them?" He goes, "Oh, I got tendon problems." I said, "No kidding, how'd that happen?" He looked at me and goes, "Oh, I don't remember."
I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I remember even when I nicked my face shaving, so I'm sure that you're going to remember. Anyway, but in our society, everything is a sickness. And when it comes to sicknesses and these ills, there's no way of clearing those things. It needs to be dealt with as sin, as crime. Capital punishment was never to be carried out in the testimony of only one person. We made mention of that. There's always to be a minimum of two witnesses in any capital punishment considerations. And I made mention of this to our students on Sunday, that God is a Trinity. He needs no one else. He's got three witnesses to every crime. And He has a right to that. Capital punishment, we kind of mentioned this already as well, would also require the involvement of the witnesses in the actual execution at times. And the text is Deuteronomy 13:6. Let me just, I went online just looking at some of the things in regards to death penalty, and I made mention of some of the cost of it right now because of how we handle it. In New York State, it costs $23 million for each person sentenced to death. And because of how we handle it, because of the way we take care of things and stretch things out for so long, it's cost New Jersey taxpayers $253 million since 1983. And the story goes on and on for all of these, simply because, and they're of course, what they're saying is, it's much easier, much cheaper, just to imprison someone for life. So take away the death penalty. And that is their argument in that. I found it interesting that there are 13 states with no death penalty. They do not hold to that. But of the ones that do, I found this interesting. New Hampshire's two formats are legal injection and hanging, still on the books. Oklahoma, lethal injection, electrocution, or firing squad, still on the books. Utah, lethal injection or firing squad. Washington, lethal injection or hanging. And so there are still some of those old Western type ways of putting someone to death. Idaho, firing squad. Delaware, lethal injection or hanging. Those are the ones that stuck out to me the most. All the way up to the year 2004, we had in 2004 we had 59 criminals put to death. In 2003, it was 65. We've kind of hovered right around that area for quite a few years now, since about 1995, and we did go quite a few years with none all across the United States. And through the years of depression, over 150 every year, and I'm sure the crimes were happening like crazy during that that portion of history. But anyway, so capital punishment is biblical. Capital punishment would at times require, top page 93, the whole congregation, the whole community or society to be involved in the execution. Numbers 15. Deuteronomy 13. And there were times when God said, gather everyone together to be a witness of what this is going to do. It was a learning lesson for them. Now, we've kind of mentioned this already, but in your notes, the purpose of capital punishment is the protection of the society. Deuteronomy 17:12, the man that will do presumptuously, premeditatedly, and will not hearken to the priest that standeth to minister there before the Lord thy God, or to judge, or unto the judge, even that man shall die. And thou shalt put away the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear, and do no more presumptuously. And the high hand of rebellion. God said, we can cure that if you'll follow my rules and do it the way I'm telling you to do it. Letter C is the killing of animals. We're not going to get in depth in this. I don't think anybody here really has a problem with this. We might, you know, you'll have some vegetarians, but that's not, most of the time, I can't speak for them, but most of the time that'll be because they just don't like the meat, they don't like the process, they don't like what is injected into them, all that stuff. Very few people actually hold to a biblical purpose for not eating meat, because there really isn't one. There's no biblical mandate on that. As a matter of fact, God said that all meat should be accepted if it's accepted with thanksgiving. 1 Timothy, he said it's all okay. Eat it. Obviously, we have to use a little bit of wisdom on that in regards to what you eat. But I just gave four illustrations in here of when it was commanded to eat, or to use, or to kill animals. Letter D is self-defense. For some reason, my notes are gone on that, and I will try and get those filled in. Not sure what happened there. So let's go to E, suicide. Suicide is defined as the act of taking one's own life voluntarily and intentionally. Self-murder, the felonious killing of oneself. Obviously, this is not anything new in the United States of America. People in the Bible did it. All the way into the Old Testament, people would fall on their sword. That was suicide, a way of ending their life. Most of the time, a king would do it when they knew they were going to be taken captive. And obviously, they felt, I'd rather die at my own sword than to go into another country and have them do to me as they will. And you know some of the stories in the Bible where they would kill the king's sons in front of him and put out his eyes. And then there were some times when they took off the toes of people. They couldn't walk. There were all kinds of atrocities. And there were times when someone would decide to take their life rather than do that. That does not in any way say that it is the right thing to do. There is nowhere in Scripture that I have found, and maybe you can correct me if you know of one, no place where God said to take your own life. God never commanded someone to do that. Although there are numerous examples of people that killed themselves in the Bible, there are no situations that God endorses or encourages suicide. Consider these examples and their circumstances to get a clear picture looking at this chart. And so here's what what we have. We have Samson. Samson, we know, to have killed himself. He asked God for one more opportunity. He put his hands on the beams or the pillars of the building, and he killed himself. But the circumstances were he compromised everything. He was abandoned by God. He didn't even realize that the Holy Spirit of God had left him. So he was hopelessly imprisoned by the enemy. Can't say that at that point he was living for God at all. We know he is in Hebrews 11 for a man of faith. I believe those were his early years. But those were the circumstances. God didn't tell him to do it. God did allow him. God didn't stop him. But he did that on his own. Number two, we have King Saul. 1 Samuel 31:4. He was also abandoned by God. He was also plagued by an evil spirit sent by the Lord. Suicide, if we talked earlier about in John 8:44, he is a murderer from the beginning, speaking of Satan. We could see it here. King Saul being tormented by an evil spirit, he killed himself. Ahithophel, he was an enemy of God and of God's chosen king David. He was self-centered. He was mad that the king didn't take his counsel. He went to his house, put things in order, and took his own life. Pretty shallow. He just didn't like that someone wasn't listening to his counsel anymore. Boy, I'll tell you what. If pastors did that when people didn't listen to the counsel, exactly. You know what's going to happen. Number four, we have Zimri, enemy of God, evil king that saw his kingdom being destroyed, and he took his own life. We have the example of Judas, Matthew 27:5, committed the grossest of all sins beyond true repentance. He repented himself, but he didn't truly repent. He was plagued and indwelt by the devil. We know that Satan entered into him, and he committed suicide. The thief cometh not but for to steal, to kill, and to destroy. And if he cannot steal from you, your joy, your purpose, all of those things, he'll try and destroy you. He can't destroy you. If he's not going to be allowed to kill you, he's going to try one of those other two formats. We know that in the illustration of Job, in the account of Job, God had to tell Satan, you can do whatever you want, don't touch his life. So we know that Satan's primary desire is to take the life of someone, to kill someone. And so we know that as we look at this concept of suicide, it's not something endorsed by God. Satan is a murderer. We have the Philippian jailer, an unsaved man that would have been killed by the government for failure to keep the prisoners. And you remember that he came out, he was ready to kill himself, and Paul said, do yourself no harm. We're all here. And so he was an unsaved man ready to commit suicide. And then we have tribulation survivors. Revelation 9:6, history's worst time to be alive. God's vengeance and anger is now unleashed on man in his rebellion, and they're going to seek to die. They're calling for the rocks to fall upon them. They want to die, but death flees from them. And so these are illustrations of suicide in the Bible. God did not warrant them, and if you look at the circumstances, none of them are people living for God, people doing what is right, people following the principles of God. And many times Satan had something to do with it. You see Judas, you see King Saul especially in that situation. Now throughout the Bible there are also examples of righteous men that sought for death, but they never acted upon it. Number one, Moses never acted upon it, sought to die. Elijah, remember him, he ran off by himself when his life was threatened, and he went off running, and he sought to die, but he never acted upon it. He wished to die, but he never acted upon it. We have Job, wished to die, but never acted upon it. Jonah, the whining prophet, still used by God in a great way, wanted to die. He never acted upon it. Simeon. The Apostle Paul says, man, it'd be better to die. But for you, it'd be better for me to stick around. Paul was not afraid to die. As a matter of fact, he said that in another situation. So we just want to make clear that this is something that is really big. It's always been there, Old Testament, New Testament, current history. It's always been there. It's nothing endorsed by God. Ben?
Do you think there's any punishment for Christians who kill themselves?
You mean by God's punishment? Obviously, because it would have to be. No, I do not. I do not. There are people that will say that that's the unpardonable sin. But that's not supported in Scripture either. But we don't know of anything. Obviously, there are Christians, there have been Christians that have done that. There have been Christians, I know of Christians, that have attempted to do that. Their circumstances got the best of them. Obviously, it's a sin that needs to be confessed for attempted. Obviously, there's not time to confess for someone who succeeds in that. But I don't know of any penalty for that. Obviously, sin... for a believer, if someone's really a believer, their sin is under the blood of Christ, they're forgiven. Past, present, and future. And 1 John 1:9 is for you and I on a daily, positionally, I'm forgiven. But every day I have sin, and I've got to take care of it. Same is true for someone who commits suicide. If they're truly a Christian, they've been forgiven already, past, present, and future. They don't have to worry about their fellowship with God at that point. So 1 John 1:9 is not going to come in. The Catholic Church will hold to that as being the unpardonable, obviously because someone can't get to the priest and give their last rites. And that's just one of those things they hold over people's heads. But anyway. Okay. Self-destruction, whether by mutilation or by suicide, always has its roots in demonic activity. Satan is destructive and would love nothing more than to take the life from its owner. That is why in the testing of Job, that God told Satan, "Behold, all that he hath is in thine power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand." And he said, "He is in thine hand, but save his life." In chapter 2, verse 6. Jesus exposed Satan's destructive tendencies as well when he warned us, "The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. I am come that you might have life, and they might have it more abundantly." And Romans 8, we do talk about that one in regards to being forgiven. And nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. All right, the last case law we want to hit on here is that of restitution. Biblical restitution. There were certain principles of liability in regards to the injury of someone. First, the guilty party was responsible for the medical expenses of the injured. So if I got into a fight with someone and they were injured, they had to go to the hospital, I'm responsible for their insurance. I'm responsible to pay for that. Second, the guilty would be responsible for the time and salary of lost time from work for the injured person. So in other words, I fight this guy, he gets hurt, he's out of work for a month, I get to pay for that. That's my responsibility. And here's the text, Exodus 21:19. "If he rise again and walk abroad upon his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit." He's done. "Only he shall pay for the loss of his time, and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed." So you're gonna be paying for that in some situations for an awfully long time. But the person who caused it was responsible for it, to take care of that. Now let's look at the fixture of the law, discovering how this law still affects us today. Letter A, to hate someone in our hearts is the equivalent of murder. Started out by saying, most of us probably feel pretty safe about this. We've never broken this command. But 1 John 3:14 shows us the heart of this commandment. "We know that we have passed from death unto life because we love the brethren. He that loveth not his brother abideth in death. Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him." Some tough statements there. Hatred, murder. Wrong thoughts, adultery. Jesus takes it a lot deeper. And we're not as innocent as we might think we are. We like to think of ourselves as innocent in a lot of these commandments, but really, we're guilty. I've hated someone before. I have. I've never taken a knife or a gun and taken someone's life. But in God's eyes, I've murdered. And it needs to be confessed as so. Barnes says it this way, he has the spirit of a murderer. He has that which, if were acted out, would lead him to commit murder, as did Cain. The private malice, the secret grudge, the envy which is cherished in the heart, is murderous in its tendency, and were it not for the outward restraints of human laws and the dread of punishment, it would often lead to the act of murder. And that is the truth for you and I. Letter B, believers should not be included in the list of those that murder. Now, obviously, this is, number one, it's obvious. Number two, it's talking about physical murder, not just in the mind. But we know that to be true even of the mind. 1 Peter 4:15, "But let none of you suffer as a murderer." If you're going to suffer, suffer for doing right. Suffer because you took a stand for righteousness. He says, don't suffer as a thief, a murderer, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. And so Paul is saying, be very careful of this. These ought not to mark our lives. we ought not to walk around taking 1 John 3 into consideration. We ought not to walk around with a reputation of being a hater. Maybe you're mad at someone, you don't like someone, keep it to yourself. Keep it to yourself. Take care of that between you and God. Don't poison other people with that. The last thing I want to make mention of is to be careful for us. is the entertainment that we have and the lightness that TV and TV shows make of murder. Why are we so callous to so many things? Because we witness it every day. For those of you who work around people who cuss all day long, it probably doesn't bother you as much to see a TV program that has cussing in it as it would for someone who works in the four walls of a church all day long. Some of you are probably a little more used to it because you hear it all the time. Well, the reason our society is so used to murder is because they witness it all the time. It is part of TV. It's a part of the video games that so many teenagers play. I mean, the video games today, they include murder, they include prostitution, they include all of the things that we would preach against. And because it's in a video game, it's okay. Doesn't make any sense to me. And it ought not make sense to us. But the Bible says fools make a mock of sin. And if you and I are watching shows that make light of that, then we need to be careful. We need to be careful of that. Any questions or comments as we close? All right, let's have a word of prayer. Let me see. Who can... Benway, would you mind praying for us?
Heavenly Father, thank you for this time you've given us to open up the Word and study these commandments. I thank you for Pastor Tumius and the time he's found the class and the preparation that you bless him. But I pray you help us as we go through our everyday life that we wouldn't hate anybody, Lord, and you would just help us to ask for forgiveness if we ever have, Lord. Pray you would be with the rest of us as we go to the next class, so that we would learn something from that and bring us back safely next week. In Jesus' name,
amen.
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 I think I wrote a note. Let me check to make sure, Dan.
You need week 5.
Last week.
And I need last week.
Can you get email okay? So if I email you a PDF file that you can print off, is that all right?
Sure.
Is that easy for you? Can you print it off okay?
Yeah, I can do that.
All right. I don't know if I have any in my office left. I can check, though.
And ditto for me.
And you need week 5? Have you emailed me yet? Do I have you in my... Do your address in my...
I can. Your V2MIA FBC.
Yeah, email me so I know for sure I've got your address correct.
Okay.
And then I will send one to you as well. I don't know if there's anybody else. Yeah, why don't you just do that for me just so I know I have your address correct.
And could I take the test that was to be handed in today that I missed last week? Could I take that right after class next week, like during the problem text class, and hand it to whoever the teacher is at that time?
Okay. Yeah, do you have a copy of it?
No. So I save it till next week, okay?
Okay.
And I'll take it then just during the class as an in-class test.
Okay.
Okay. And okay, great.
All right. Yes, because then I'd have to buy your lunch.
Oh, all right. Okay.